Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the Metrospective presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. I'm Ted Berg. I am joined, as always, in Zoom conference by The Athletic's Mets beat writer, Tim Britton. And Tim, as you know, sometimes we record this show Monday morning, sometimes we record this show Tuesday morning, and every time we discuss it and every time I forget it. And so on Sunday, when I was listening to the Mets game, thinking there was a possibility we'd be recording Monday, and I hear the news that Jeff McNeil has left the game with a hamstring injury, that Michael Conforto has left the game with a hamstring injury, just adding to this incredible existential rash of injuries to this team, I think, okay, this is the rock bottom moment. And if we do a show Monday, you know, we can say it's only going to get better from here, because there's no way they could be hit with even worse luck. But as it turned out, we were due to record this show on Tuesday, as we are. And in Monday night's game, after three more strong innings, Taijuan Walker left the game with a side injury. And a few innings later, Kevin Pillar, already filling in from the bench because of the injuries the Mets have suffered, a guy who, despite pedestrian stats, seems like he has been right in the middle of every big rally this season, gets hit in the face with a 94-mile-an-hour fastball and is left bloodied by home plate. Somehow manages to get up under his own power and walk off the field, and later tweet that he was okay and point out in the tweet via hashtag that his hit by pitch led to the winning run in the game. You are a man of letters, I know, and this feels like a moment absolutely rich with symbolism. I just don't know how to read it. How do you unpack this?
Yeah, I mean, that was a very scary moment with Pillar in particular. We've seen some guys get hit up in that area, and you're always hoping, you know, whenever a pitch goes up towards a guy's head, you hope that it gets more helmet than anything, that it doesn't strike them directly in the face the way this one did with Pillar. And once you saw blood immediately,
a lot of blood, yeah,
which is very scary. You know, I think after Sunday and you lose Conforto and McNeil, I had seen some fans comparing it to 2009 with the Mets. And mm-hmm. I thought, this is premature. 2009, it got absurd. You had Luis Castillo missing time because he slipped on a glove on the dugout steps. You had John Neese collapsing on the mound.
Yeah, I was
throwing a warm-up pitch.
I was going to compare it to that John Neese moment when it's like, how could this get any worse? And then you have this like really dramatic, awful thing happen.
And last Monday night seemed to be like, yeah, we're going full 2009 here, because you have Walker leaving and then you have Pillar getting hit in the face, you know, the way Wright was hit in the head in August of 2009. Mm-hmm. So that's what I thought of originally. The other thing that I, you know, they said it on the broadcast and I looked it up, is that Pillar has been hit there before.
Yeah.
Not quite the same fashion.
But in the chin with 97 from Denelson Lamet.
Right. And the, you know, they mentioned it that he came back the next day. I looked it up. He hit 370 for the next week, which is a lot of times, you know, a guy might come back, but there's kind of a lingering and very justifiable fear or anxiety in the batter's box. He didn't show it last time.
Yeah.
You know, he had mentioned at that point, this was 2 years ago when he was in San Francisco, maybe wearing a C-flap helmet. I do wonder if this is the one that gets him to start wearing that helmet that a lot of players have started wearing over the last 3 or 4 years to provide a little bit more protection of the face itself.
And I think the moment was made all the more emotional and difficult by watching Braves pitcher Jacob Webb, who you could just see coming unraveled on the mound. It was a hard thing to watch.
Yeah, I mean, you see pitchers a lot of times, they you can tell that they feel bad, but that was maybe the starkest example of a guy just really feeling it, on the mound while they were tending to Pilar, and the Braves came out to make the pitching change, and then in the dugout afterward, and the cameras stayed on him as coaches came up to him to try to calm him down, I guess, or help him feel a little bit better about what had happened. But that was, you realize how difficult it is on both sides there, that, when he is next on the mound, he will also have a bit of anxiety about that, and maybe, has to regain that kind of unthinking confidence that comes when you throw 95 miles an hour.
And like I said, Pilar tweeted that he felt okay, and he did have a CAT scan. We don't know how much time he will miss, but his absence in that game left the Mets with an outfield of three players who, and Gary Cohen pointed this out as well, had a combined six career major league at-bats. We've been talking a lot about, how impressive this depth was, and going out and signing major league backup players like Jonathan Villar and like Kevin Pillar. And yet here we have this purely, and all teams deal with injury. Certainly looking at the Atlanta Braves, you see that Huascar Ulloa, a guy you mentioned recently who had been their best pitcher this year, punched a dugout bench after a bad outing and will be out for months with a broken hand. Ronald Acuna Jr., their best player, one of the best players in the majors, you saw on a ball last night, is just clearly not running right. He's obviously tentative. He's got an ankle issue going on. So the Mets aren't the only team banged up, but they are almost certainly the team that is the most banged up.
Yeah, after the game, Tomas Nido was talking to us over Zoom, and he was wearing the Bench Mob t-shirt that the Mets have had made with their five original members of the bench, and I thought it was striking, that shirt, you've got Jonathan Villar.
Those are now those are your cornerstone guys.
You've got Villar and Pete and Pilar on there. They've both started the last 14 games. We'll obviously see what Pilar's status is moving forward. We'll probably find out more on Tuesday, because as much as it is a positive sign that he tweeted late Monday night that he felt okay, you still want to have the kind of a more formal thing than a tweet. On the other side of the shirt, you had Albert Almora Jr. He's on the injured list. Luis Guillorme, he's on the injured list. So in the middle, it was Nito himself is in the middle of the shirt. He's the only guy who's still a member of the Bench Mob. For those guys, you've got guys, VR is going to be in the lineup for the foreseeable future. You've got Jose Peraza is now an everyday part of your lineup. Jhenashree Fargis is probably going to be your everyday center fielder, even more so now until Nimmo or Pilar are back. And then you've got Khalil Lee, who had his first major league at-bat on Monday night, and Jake Hager, who had his first major league at-bat over the weekend and had never played right field until he had to play it for eight innings on Sunday. So there's a lot of moving parts, a lot of inexperience, and a lot of trying to tread water here until you get some people back, which the Mets hope happens, within the next, maybe the next 7 to 10 days with people like J.D. Davis and Brandon Nimmo.
Yeah, you mentioned Nimmo and Davis. Right now on the injured list, the Mets have Jose Martinez, long forgotten, but on the injured list since the start of the year. Dellin Betances, also largely forgotten and perhaps mercifully on the injured list, given how he was pitching. Carlos Carrasco, Albert Almora Jr., Jacob deGrom, Brandon Nimmo, J.D. Davis, Luis Guillorme, Michael Conforto, Jeff McNeil, Seth Lugo, and Noah Syndergaard. Now, Noah Syndergaard, a guy that I think we at various points of the season would have said is the furthest away of so many of the Mets' injured players. He's about to make his first rehab appearance on Wednesday in Port St. Lucie. Are we going to see Syndergaard before we see a bunch of these other guys? Because if he is, and I understand there's you want him to throw his first pitches coming back from that surgery in a controlled environment. And so one, two outings in the minors, you definitely need, because there's going to be adrenaline and there's going to be, it's a different speed. Once you get to the majors, you want to iron out all those last kinks. But I can't see the logic in giving him, a prolonged rehab stint to stretch out if he's good to go and they've got no one on the team.
Yeah, I'm really interested in seeing that first rehab appearance for him will be Wednesday night for Port St. Lucie, the St. Lucie Mets in low A. I'm really interested in seeing how long he goes in that. Is that an inning? Is that two innings? Is that like, oh, he can throw four innings now? Because that will tell you how much he needs to build up. My guess is it's going to be probably two innings or so. And it's interesting, you know, Luis Rojas, when talking to the media on Monday, initially said that both Lugo and Syndergaard were going to pitch for Syracuse, and they're both pitching for St. Lucie. Not only is that like a lower level, which tells you they might be a little farther away, but also those levels are not part of the kind of quasi bubble built around a team's major league squad and its AAA team. So for them to get to the major league team from St. Lucie or to get to Syracuse from St. Lucie, they have to undergo a couple days of intake testing, which is, you know, not as hard for a pitcher to do. A pitcher doesn't pitch play every day the way an everyday player does. You can hear it in the titles that we give those people. Mm-hmm. So that you know, I think most of the like shorter rehab stints we'll see this year will be in Syracuse. Like, you know, Nimmo started one the other day and had to halt it because he was still feeling pain in Syracuse. JD Davis will start one in Syracuse on Tuesday. But it tells you that it's not like a one stint and into the majors for either Lugo or Syndergaard. I think Lugo, they had said, you know, three or four outings where they can get him maybe to more than one inning to get him back-to-back appearances. And he was just put on the 60-day injured list on Monday, which is more of a procedural move. Like, he also now cannot come back until May 31st, which seemed pretty close to being the case anyway. With Syndergaard, I think it's going to be a few starts. You know, I don't think it's one or two and then he's there. I think, you know, the New York Post, Mike Puma reported that he was going to be with St. Lucie through the end of the month, and then they would kind of reassess. So that probably gives you, I'm trying to do the math here, that's probably three starts with St. Lucie. And then you, you know, maybe move him up to Syracuse for an additional one or two. And then, you know, that gets you to mid-June where he can come back kind of where they thought he might come back all year long.
And then what's the latest on Jacob deGrom? Because maybe there's some glimmer of hope on the horizon there as well.
Yeah, I mean, he's done his kind of normal between starts work the last few days leading to a bullpen session on Tuesday. If that goes well, you know, deGrom usually throws his two bullpen sessions between starts. So he's kind of operating as if he had started on Sunday. He did what he did Monday would be what he does after the day after a start. Tuesday would be his first bullpen. If that goes well, then he kind of you can kind of track him in for a potential Friday start. That's the first day he can come off the injured list. A Friday start in Miami, rejoining the rotation at that point. You know, they can, because they've got the day off, like Marcus Stroman can pitch that day. You know, it's not like they need to throw a bullpen game or call up someone to make that start if DeGrom can't. So they have a little bit of wiggle room, a day or two this weekend. But if all goes well on Tuesday, I think you can slot DeGrom in for the weekend at some point against the Marlins.
And that feels good. I assume we don't know much more about Conforto and McNeil other than that it's hamstring things, and those tend to be injuries you want to be kind of slow and careful with, lest you lose a guy for the whole season.
Yeah, and they haven't put a grade on either of them. I think just watching it seemed like the Conforto one was more serious, and McNeil has had little injuries like this in the past couple of years, and has generally come back, you know, within the 10 to 14 days. So I think that's probably what their thought process is on that. I'm guessing they haven't actually explicitly said that on him. And then Conforto, it might be a bit longer because it didn't seem like a 10-day injury when he had it running down the line at the Trop. So that one might be a bit more longer term.
They did win the game Monday night, as I mentioned. they are now 19-16 on the season. They have a one-game lead over the Phillies, four games in the loss column because they played so many fewer games in the division. It seems like they are held together with like feathers and children's glue stick, like not even the appropriate glue. I'm pulling examples from my own kitchen. Looking right now at some craft feathers and glue sticks. It's all improvisational here. Is there a path through this for the Mets? Is there a way that they can sort of, because we've heard this so many times, right? Like with the Mets over the years, like, let's just stay the course, like hold down the fort, whatever metaphor you want to use, caulk the wagon until the reinforcements arrive. Is that feasible?
I mean, I think the path through is kind of the blueprint you saw on Monday night, which is really good pitching. I mean, that was an outstanding game from the, you know, it's reminds me of like the Astros six pitcher no hitter. Like the game did not, the pitching plan did not go according to plan, but you got really good outings from just about everyone. I mean, I think Trevor Bayh's the only one.
I would say I didn't envision a situation in which in the middle of May we'd be like, is Sean Reed Foley the Mets MVP?
Right, that we've talked to him after several games this year. I did not expect that. You know, between Taijuan Walker, Sean Reed Foley, Jerry Familia. I mean, the Braves got to the seventh inning, got into the eighth inning, and their only hit was a seeing eye single by starting pitcher Max Fried. That was their only base runner at that point. They made a little scary against May and Diaz. So, you know, the Mets, they need to win the game started by their healthy starters, which I guess is down to Marcus Stroman and David Peterson, and when DeGrom comes back. And then they need to continue to get kind of unexpected contributions from some of their long relievers like Reed Foley. You know, we're talking Tuesday morning. We don't know who's going to start the game Tuesday night for the Mets, whether it's them using an opener for someone like Joey Lucchesi or Robert Gazelman. They need those guys to pitch reasonably well. Lucchesi has been the one in the in that mix who hasn't pitched well to this point. And then they need their healthy everyday players that were planned to be in the starting lineup to produce. So that's Francisco Lindor, that's James McCann, that's Dominic Smith. You know, guys who to this point have not had their usual level of success. You know, Smith, I think, is coming around. Had a couple more hits or one hit last night, and has looked better at the plate. Really, the last, you know, pretty much the whole month of May after a struggling April. Lindor got there and then had a rough series at Tampa. And then McCann had a big hit off the bench on Monday night. So you hope that's the start of something for him to build some confidence, get rolling a little bit. You know, they're facing a fair amount of left-handers and have the last couple of days. And that's generally McCann's strength. So you're hoping that leads to something for him. You know, those are the guys who are going to need to carry you offensively, because I don't know how much you can count on Jose Peraza and Jhenasree Vargas in the bottom of the lineup to do what you know what they've done so far. Peraza has played pretty well, and Vargas had a big hit on Monday.
And of course, they need to sign you on a Cespedes.
That is, you know, that's I was looking at different options. It's amazing how many free agent outfielders that have Mets connections, because it's like Yoenis Cespedes, Jose Bautista is officially listed as a free agent on the list I looked at. Austin Jackson. It's a bunch of guys who have played for the Mets in the outfield in the not too distant past. Yeah. But yeah, the list of players who are available is not inspiring.
Yeah, someone got. I mean, I would ride with Yoenis Cespedes forever, right? Like, just because of his production for the Mets when he came over after the trade and the next season, and just like how absolutely cool that guy was as a baseball player, between, you know, first his at-bat music about himself, and later, you know, the Lion King intro, just and like the swagger he had. I feel like there would always be a place for Cespedes on my team, but I sort of half jokingly tweeted that they should do it, and a couple of people got really mad at me. Like, you know, we're like, really? I don't know. It's just, to be clear, it's not going to happen, right? This is a guy who last year sort of like suddenly disappeared on this very team. He was well within his rights to opt out of the season, but apparently he did so without a ton of communication. I can't imagine that left a good taste in anybody's mouth there. He's a guy we know marches to the beat of his own drummer. There's a lot of context necessary there, I think, for understanding it, and I would defend him for that too, because he's so awesome at baseball and has had such a insane life, it seems. But it's not going to happen. They're not going to sign Cespedes. You stay the course, and because by the time he'd come back, By the time he'd be ready, Nimmo should be back and Davis should be back and maybe McNeil and maybe Elmore should be back. So pump the brakes on that. I still love the idea. I don't think it's going to happen. I recognize it as unrealistic.
Did you say that you tweeted something about Yoenis Cespedes and got a polarized, divisive reaction from it?
Yeah, I did. Oh, it's hard to believe.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
I mean, you know, it's Twitter.
Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
We have a good question from a reader that is not about injuries. For the Mets, and I thought that would be a nice change of pace. This comes from Andrew, who's asked this question before. We got a lot of really good questions now in the queue. So thanks for emailing, and if you have one, please direct it at us on Twitter at Tim Britton or me at OG Ted Berg, or email us at asktedberg@gmail.com. Andrew wants to know. He says, "I want to know what your favorite ballpark to travel to is, and also your least favorite." So. I think you, for being a beat writer for many years, have certainly done a lot more traveling than I have, but I've been to the overwhelming majority of major league parks. I think I've never been to a game in, spent plenty of time in Tampa. I've never been to a game at a Rays home game, because I've only been in Tampa for spring. I've never been to the Braves new stadium, never been to the Rangers new stadium. I believe that's it for active stadiums for me. Have you been to all 30?
I've been in all 29 of the 30. I haven't been in the new one in Texas. And I've been in San Diego and Arizona I went to the team store in San Diego and I stayed across the street. So I guess I haven't actually been in the stadium proper. And then Arizona, I went for a press conference, but not for a game. So those are the three, I guess, now that I haven't been to. But I've hit the other 27.
What's your number one?
It's probably San Francisco, just because it's, you know, like this question is always, there's two different ways to answer it. There's like, what's a cool stadium that a fan would really enjoy going to? And then what's cool as a writer to go to, because our experience is different than a fan's experience. Like the positioning of the press box matters. So like, I love.
Oh, and in whatever they're calling it, AT&T Park, or I don't even know the current name. But San Francisco, it's perfect. It's like the best press box view in the country.
Right. So like, you know, I really like Pittsburgh as well for the view, but that press box is very high. I think it's the second highest in the majors outside of Washington, which means, you know, different things about like having to get down to the clubhouse at the end of the night or something like that. San Francisco combines kind of both element. Like it's a great place to see a game as a fan. There's a lot of different viewpoints. The view is really nice, and it is super convenient as a member of the press that you are very low behind home plate. I think the three stadiums where you feel particularly low and close to the action are San Francisco, Baltimore, which doesn't have air conditioning in the press box, which is a real problem in the middle of a Baltimore summer. And then Tampa, actually. So as much as like everything about the atmosphere at the Trop is miserable. Like, I've covered playoff games there. I've covered walk-off home runs in playoff games there. And it gets loud, but it's still, like, not the same as it would be at other locations. But for a beat writer, for a member of the press, it is so convenient there because the press box is low. You can, like, see the movement on the pitches in a way you can't at most other places. And you can just, like, run down to the clubhouse. It's, like, 10 steps down to the clubhouse. And the clubhouses are nice and large, so, like, when you're covering a team that is having, say, a champagne celebration in the visiting clubhouse, you want the Trop to be the place where it happens because there's actual room to move around.
So I'm taking your word at the Mets celebration in Wrigley in 2015.
You know, yeah, I was not there for that. I cannot imagine that was comfortable. Like, I, you know, covering every once in a while, hopping over to the road clubhouse at Fenway for some big playoff events. Like, I remember when David Ortiz hit the grand slam in the ALCS and Torii Hunter flipped over the wall. Like, the crowd around Torii Hunter in the visiting clubhouse was the entire clubhouse. Like, yeah, no one else could be. It was like him and like 50 people of the media, and that was all that could fit in that room.
Yeah, a Red Sox playoff game, there's a 0% chance you're going to hear a single thing. Like, the guy could be in the center of the scrum on, like, an insane racist tirade, and you would have no idea. You wouldn't even let your editor know, like, hey, this guy just said some really crazy stuff that's going to make a lot of headlines, because you would have no idea until you went back and reviewed the audio. Like, you just have to stand so far, and it's just such a crazy crush. But from, I don't know, so for me, San Diego is the nicest park in baseball. I just think it's so beautifully done. I went to the All-Star game there, so I have covered the games. I have covered games there. I think I may have gone there and covered like one other game when I was in Southern California anyway, and like basically just like didn't want to pay for a ticket, so I went in with my card and wrote a story. Probably not the type of thing I should admit in a professional forum, but that's how it goes for me sometimes. If I'm in a city and I had a place to publish these things, you could always just sort of walk in and write a story if you want to see a ball game. And so I love San Diego. I just think the way the park is like built into the city is so incredible, and I love that they didn't go. All of the new parks, you know, are like the retro, like the Citi Field is, and certainly Camden Yards was the first of them. And so there's that, like, that retro feel to me is like a little bit done. Like once Camden Yards did it and PNC and the first wave of those parks, it was like, it's cool to see a more contemporary design. And I love the way, you know, it's easy to make something cool in San Diego because San Diego is so beautiful and the weather is constantly perfect, but they did it right there. I would also say, you know, in terms of travel, because you mentioned San Francisco, and like while San Francisco is awesome and the park is incredible, from my experience as media, it's so expensive to stay anywhere near San Francisco that you, like, while the ballpark is in a walkable downtown area, you don't stay in that walkable downtown area. I'm staying in like Daly City, and I have to either take a very long Uber ride or rent a car and deal with parking. And like that stuff is all sort of a headache. Whereas Kansas City is, I think Kauffman Stadium is a wildly underrated stadium. It's in no way a walkable downtown stadium. It is out on the outskirts of the city. But Kansas City is an extremely drivable place. Like, you can just get from one side of Kansas City to the other in however many miles it is, it's that many minutes. It's like, you know, you look at the Google Maps and surprise yourself. And I just, like, I have a soft spot in my heart as a Shea Stadium product of sorts for the old municipal perfectly symmetrical like 1955 through 1975 ballpark. And so love Kauffman Stadium, love Dodger Stadium too.
Yeah, like I wonder if that is a thing that Shea Stadium, people who grew up with Shea Stadium feel a natural affinity for Kauffman Stadium, because I think it's probably the stadium that plays the closest to what Shea played like. Because like when I would play like What If Sports or something, and you put your team in a stadium, I would pick Shea or Kauffman essentially, because they were, you know, favored toward pitchers, but not too much. They had the symmetrical design, so you know everything played the same in right field as in left field, and in the gaps the same way. That is one thing I dislike about City. Probably my biggest problem with City Field is that the outfield wall is just a total mess in terms of angles and weird quirks in it. And like
it's a gimmick. It's a gimmick, right? Like, mm-hmm. and it makes sense at Fenway Park, where you're building it into the city, where you have to make the right one. Like, if you think of how Fenway Park was built, or look into how Fenway Park was built, like there are whole sections of seating that don't really face the right angle because they just sort of had to cram everything into the space they had. City Field is in the middle of a parking lot. Right, like a budding a section of New York City that doesn't have running water. Like they could have made this symmetrical. There's no reason for it to have like the Mohs zone.
Yeah, like my number one pet peeve is that, and this goes for every park, but
I guess it's not the Mohs. Do they have a? Is it still branded in any way the what used to be the Mohs zone? Because now Mohs is gone, right? Like the Mohs zone has outlasted the Mohs.
Yeah, I don't know what it's called. I don't know if I don't think they've had people there. I mean, it was a gym last year. Like you could saw the workout equipment for players. When a player hits a home run, I think everyone should know that it is a home run. And so I don't like when balls go over the fence or over the line on the fence, rebound into play, and no one knows what's going on. And that's true at several different parks. There are other really distinctive parks that I like a lot. Seattle. I think is really nice. I said Pittsburgh, Fenway, having worked at Fenway was phenomenal. I like Marlins Park. I like it a little bit less now that it doesn't have the home run statue and the green walls, because I thought that really stood out. You knew like you were at a different game when you were there. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a cool thing about different parks that they don't really have anymore. But those are my favorites. What is your least favorite? What is the one you don't like going to?
That's a good question. I mean, I'm reminded of a tweet from The Athletic's Andy McCullough, who and I forget how he worded it, but he said something about like on Marriott's website it says where do you want to go today, and I always feel a little disingenuous typing in St. Louis. And there are really nice parts of St. Louis and nice things about St. Louis and good food you can have in St. Louis, but one time while staying in St. Louis, where the ballpark is in sort of a downtown area, but it's like a very sort of one thin strip of very touristy commercial downtown area, which has like the arch and the ballpark and a bunch of things that cater to all the tourists who come see those things. And so if you stay there, like where I was staying one year in the playoffs, the closest place to get coffee for me was inside a casino. So every time I wanted, and I drink a ton of coffee. So every time I wanted non-hotel coffee, I had to go into a casino past one of my weaknesses, the roulette tables. And so it was like every coffee cost me $45. I could talk for a while about St. Louis. I don't love going to St. Louis, and the park is fine. It's completely bland park. It's just like one of these run of the mill newer stadiums. So there's nothing really that stands out about it. And the experience I love traveling and I loved traveling covering baseball games because like I love seeing different cities and to me the St. Louis experience was never the most pleasant for a visiting city.
Yeah, I think that's one where the ballpark itself is fine. You know, it's like you said, it's kind of one of those later modern ballparks, modern throwback ballparks. So you know, places like St. Louis and Cincinnati and Washington don't stand out quite the same way that some of the others designed similarly do. And it is it's inconvenient for a writer. The press box is pretty high, and it's difficult. You got to fight through the crowd to get down to the clubhouse after a game, which is not great because the first games I covered there were in the World Series, so there were a lot of people. The area around, yeah, there's like, you know, this is inside beat reporting, but sometimes you like to get a drink after the game. And the area around the ballpark in St. Louis did not have like places that were open at midnight or past midnight. And that is frustrating because, you cover a game, you want to go and decompress a little bit with perhaps a beverage And St. Louis, it is difficult to find such a location late at night. So that's one I don't like. I think the AL West in terms of ballpark, Oakland is not great, and not telling any new tales there. Mm-hmm. Anaheim, when they moved the press box out to right field, which I sat in that press box once and I couldn't see like anything that was going on. The sun was glaring right into.
You can't really see the plate. You have to like crane to see the batter. I've also covered a game there. Yeah.
And so they've got like the small little jerry-rigged press box behind home plate that they'll seat some people in that I always manage to work my way into. But there's like no access to water or other soft drinks, which is fine, except I once covered a game that went at least 19 innings there. I forget if it was 19, 20, 18, something like that. Mike Trout hit a big home run. So, you know, you get thirsty over the course of a 6.5 hour baseball game. And then actually the Mets are in Atlanta. I've had most of my most miserable reporting experiences have been in Atlanta because of long rain delays. So it doesn't matter if it's Turner Field or Truist Park. I preferred Turner Field. It was closer to anything else that was interesting. Mm-hmm. But, you know, having like the Mets played a Memorial Day-night doubleheader in Atlanta in 2018. And I had to fly in from Milwaukee that morning, get there, kind of like go straight from the airport to the ballpark for a 1 p.m. game, which they played. They lost on a walk-off home run. Mets fans may remember it. It was, I believe, Charlie Culberson hit the home run off of Seth Lugo. And then the night game, which, you know, the day game ends at 4, the night game was scheduled to start at 7, was delayed 3 hours by rain, so it didn't start until 10. And the Mets won that game, but I, you know, I'd been at the ballpark from like 10:30 in the morning till 2 in the morning the next day before I finally got to leave. So I don't like Atlanta for long rain delays.
You mentioned that the Mets are in Atlanta. They play two more starting Tuesday. They got teams Tuesday. We don't know who's pitching, and Wednesday when it'll be David Peterson, then they got a day off Thursday and back Friday against the Marlins going to Miami, and we will be back at some point before that Marlins series to talk about these next two games and all of the new injuries that the Mets might meet inside of them. Tim, it is always a pleasure.
Adios.
Peace out.